Jennifer, thank you very much for the introductory remarks and a kind word about me and about RFERL. This is an honor. It's such a distinguished audience, and friends like Karen Hughes and Peter Ackerman, Steve Hadley, and others. Want to thank Mrs. Bush and President Bush for their contribution and their hosting of this, and Jim Glassman, who is a former colleague, and when he was chairman of the Broadcast Board of Governors, a former boss. Thank you. It's a fantastic conference. I've just come back from Afghanistan, where we have an operation. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty has this old-fashioned name, but we broadcast in the Middle East, in Central Asia, Russia, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and we do radio and television, all the social media. Just came back from Afghanistan, and one of the many interesting meetings I had was with a group of tribal leaders. Now, these were all men, and they come from a country which is largely rural and illiterate. And these men sat with me for a couple hours, dressed in long tunics with headdress and long, very long beards, actually. Not just beards, very long beards. Some spoke Dari, some spoke Pashto, some were Uzbek, some were Tajiks. Some came from villages in Afghanistan where the only way in and out is by donkey. And they did what many of us, I'll concede or confess I do, in the middle of a meeting. They spent a good deal of their time checking their BlackBerries and their iPhones and their cell phones. It is still very much a radio country, but it is not immune to the latest of technologies. For these men, they have to. It's not just a question of desire, because the Taliban does too. And the Taliban is fast and fierce and effective. The Taliban likes social media. The Taliban likes text messaging. The first thing I'd like to say is a general observation. Anybody who is interested in the advancement of freedom, which is what the Bush Institute is about, what the Bush legacy is about, what this conference is about, has to be interested in this subject of new technology and social media. It has literally dramatically transformed the way we think about dissent, political opposition, and political power. It is, to borrow an expression, it's a bit of a cliche, it is a game changer. What's obvious about it? Well, it breaks the monopoly of information of authoritarians. How different it is for today, a company like mine, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, than during the Cold War. In the Cold War, it was hard too, but there was an Iron Curtain, there was a Soviet Union, there's a monopoly, and we wanted to penetrate the curtain with an alternative to that monopoly. It breaks that monopoly, I think, forever. In 2008, there's an earthquake in China. BBC learns about it from Twitter. And the last time there was an earthquake of that magnitude in China, the Chinese authorities were able to withhold information and cover it up for 3 months. It's impossible today. It creates a new accountability. It also creates new spotlights. Last summer, right after the fraudulent election in Iran, a young woman named Neda was murdered in the streets of Tehran. Well, amateur photographers posted these terrible pictures, but important pictures on Facebook and YouTube, spread virally on the internet. Millions of Iranians and millions of people around the world encountered firsthand the viciousness and the brutality of the Iranian regime. It does other things too, quite obviously. It empowers large numbers of people, far beyond traditional elites. It has this democratizing effect. It facilitates, it actually coordinates, mobilizes, and facilitates protests. We have expressions now like Twitter revolution, which started from Moldova. It actually plays a central role in bringing people out and affecting political change. Now, to make those observations makes me an enthusiast, but being an enthusiast is not necessarily a utopian. And there's another side to this coin also, and we heard about it a little bit this morning. If we're talking about new media, social media, new technologies, and the advancement of freedom and democracy, you are talking about a kind of competition or a kind of warfare. And this kind of warfare, in some ways, is no different than traditional military warfare. Every measure invites a countermeasure. right? There's a Belarusian dissident and blogger and technology expert named Evgeny Morozov, who has observed two things. In his own country, Belarus, social media was very effective in bringing out people to the streets, creating flash mobs, gestures, symbols of protest and dissent. But the trouble was the Belarusian government, they like social media too. And they started beating the protesters to the sites, welcoming them with digital cameras so they could record who came and who didn't come. And that first effect was getting fence sitters off the fence to participate. If you look at Facebook, if you get these things through these various means, you say, if my friends are doing it, maybe it's okay, or maybe it's a good idea, or maybe me too. But when the government of Belarus reacted, the fence sitters got off the fence back in the other direction. Separated very quickly, those who have real courage and those who follow by fashion or fad. June 13th, the day after the fraudulent elections in Iran last summer, Andrew Sullivan, very gifted writer, gifted blogger for The Atlantic, he wrote, "The message here from Twitter is, you cannot stop people any longer," close quote. The trouble is, yes, you can. When people ask me, what happened to the Green Movement? We don't read about it anymore. It's not so prominent. Well, nothing happened to it. They're there. The discontent is there. The dedication is there. The liberal values are there. But what happened is the momentary advantage they had through Facebook and YouTube and Twitter was robbed. And the regime organized and recaptured the moment very quickly. And this regime in Iran is very good at surveilling, at infiltrating, at manipulating. If it were a war, you'd talk about battlefield dominance. And that's what the Iranian government has done. I was in Dubai recently meeting with a number of young Iranians, one of them active in the Green Movement. He said, literally, we no longer know where to go or when to go. Simple things, communication. Well, that's been disbanded or disabled internally. It's even more complicated than that. We broadcast to Iran. We have a local brand called Radio Farda. One thing that we encountered frequently in the more turbulent months of the last year was stories that would come through social media about a protest on a Thursday at 5 o'clock, let's say, and well-meaning warnings, someone was out there, don't go. There's snipers. They're pre-positioned on the roofs. And the protest wouldn't materialize. And there were no snipers. And the government had disbanded the demonstration before the demonstrators ever arrived. So disinformation that worked during the Soviet period through various means, the same kind of disinformation through the new technology, very effective. On countermeasures, you have countries like Iran and Russia and China that have become world champions. They like social media. And if we're talking in a conference like this about how we support cyber dissidents, those governments are thinking very carefully about how to create cyber militias. And they are highly motivated, and they are very well trained, and they are very well financed. Second point, social media quite obviously empowers the advocates of freedom, but it's empowering others too, outside of government. Islamic extremists adore social media. Former colleague of mine, Daniel Kimmage, has done very important work on Iraq, for example. Daniel told me he was in Iraq a few months ago, and he noticed that every young kid on the street has, from Baghdad to Kirkuk, has a cell phone, and they love it as a platform for visual content. They adore it. And you know the two most popular things? Number one, jihadist videos, and number two, pornography. It's a problem. Ultra-rightists like social media, Islamic extremists like social media, post-communists like social media, the Taliban like social media, as I said. And you know, they don't just use it to lie, if I may say. They do lie. If there's a NATO strike and innocent civilians have been injured or killed, in seconds, the Taliban is text messaging 200 dead. They don't know how many dead. They just want to get out, get first, and get a hard and conventional wisdom. They lie. They don't worry about lying. But the Taliban is shrewder than that. They're also using social media to make an argument. And they know the weaknesses of the current system in Afghanistan. There are two: security and perception about justice. It is a country fraught with weak institutions and corruption. And the Taliban is making an argument, you're never going to get it from a U.S.-backed government, you'll get it from us, security and justice. There's an argument. The third point, the final point I want to make, while we look at the flip side of the good and the positive and the effective of social media new technology, the third comment I want to make is, it may be a game changer if you're talking about advancing freedom and promoting democracy, but it's still not the game. That's what I think. I think the game is still ideas, and the game is still content. That's something that this Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and over here, Karen Hughes, both Jim Glassman and Karen Hughes understood very well, that the technologies are absolutely vital, but without the proper intelligent content, focus, promotion of responsible discussion, it's empty. It's just a vessel. You can't affect change inside a society without some intellectual and conceptual work and heavy lifting. Or put in shorthand, Twitter could tell people when and where to show up in the town hall square. And the protesters may even succeed in toppling the government. But if the protesters assume power, Twitter has told them nothing about how to govern, how to plant and grow democratic institutions, how to promote and inculcate and defend values that are associated with democracy, like tolerance, like respect for diversity, like pluralism. This is still the world of ideas. Whether you're battling Islamic extremism or battling the new authoritarianism, we, on the freedom side, still have to make the case for the virtues of these things. President Bush said this morning, and I think absolutely rightfully so, he said, freedom is a universal value, and that's why we're here. But saying freedom is a universal value does not mean that democracy and decent, accountable government are inevitable. That takes an immense amount of intellectual and political work. Finally, what to do? Two thoughts. I think to get it right, to employ the new technologies in the right way, in the right strategic framework, two things are important. One is, before we talk about the technology, let's talk about what our larger strategic aims as a country actually are. I think this means, and I think it's urgent, I think it means revitalizing the freedom agenda. Steve Hadley, you said this morning, half jokingly, but I think only half, that the United States is in a bit of a freedom recession. And I think that's true. And I think there are reasons for that. I think the way to get us on back on track, I think in American life and politics and in Washington, it requires some measure of introspection from both sides of the aisle. I think for those of us who supported the war in Iraq, even if we removed a dreadful tyrant, even if the surge has been successful, even if the medium to long-term prospects for Iraq are good, I think we supporters of the war have to acknowledge that the price has been exceptionally high in blood, in treasure, in credibility, and the price of Iraq has damaged the freedom agenda. I believe that. I think opponents of the war have to acknowledge that the freedom agenda was never exclusively about Iraq, and certainly never about regime change by force. The freedom agenda was much broader and much deeper, and to suggest otherwise is a caricature, and a caricature made for self-serving and partisan reasons. I think to get us back on track, the new foreign policy establishment in Washington will have to end its romance with the new realpolitik, because it's wooden, it's one-dimensional, it's simplistic, it's not consonant with American values in the fullest sense of the word, and at the end of the day, it won't work. I think we also have to listen to dissidents. Many of these projects involve people from other countries who simply know better than we do. And they bring, like the panel this morning, they bring inspiration to us to remind us of the values we take for granted, but we may not take for granted, for our own reasons of national self-interest and also of values. Second and last point, I'll emphasize it again. Jim, you said it in your introductory remarks this morning, as powerful, central, and important as the new media and the social technology and Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, all these things are, it's still a tool. So I'm going to hit this point one more time. It's still a tool. I think Jeff Jacoby from the Boston Globe mentioned this morning, or asked today about the relevance of Samizdat, underground literature and its usefulness or relevance to new media. Well, this gets us back to the Soviet Union. In my company, RFERL, when great men like Václav Havel would say, RFE helped end communism, what Havel means is not a radio station. That doesn't end anything. It's a radio station. But what he means is media like us then and like others today can be an absolute essential transmitter or conveyor belt of ideas, of content, of responsible discussion and debate, which is absolutely essential. Let me read you a quote that I'm very fond of that gets us to the nub of this, and then I'll close, and if we have time, take a question or two. This is a quote about supporting democracy and freedom abroad. The quote reads, "This effort is not primarily the task of arms. When the soul of a nation finally speaks, what's more, the institutions that arise may reflect customs and traditions very different from our own. America will not impose our style of government on the unwilling," close quote. That's President George W. Bush from the second inaugural address. I think it's a brilliant quote, if I may say, and it hits the nail on the head. I'm going to match it with something I heard in Afghanistan. I met with an imam who is head of a mosque in Kabul, about 50 years old, reserved, I don't know how many Americans he meets, not unfriendly, but reserved. And at the end of the conversation, he said to me, "We don't want the Taliban. We don't want Islamic extremism." And I said, "Well, what do you want? What should Afghanistan look like?" And he said, "Well, not like America or Western Europe. We're a traditional society. We're a very religious Islamic country." And I said, I tested him a little bit. I said, "Should it look like Iran or Saudi Arabia?" He said, "No, extreme, violent, repressive." And I said, "What should it look like?" And he said, "I don't know. It should be moderate, tolerant, pluralistic, but it should look like ours. We should own it. It should be authentic." I think that matches perfectly with the quotation and remark by President Bush. I think that that is the kind of conversation that we need to broaden and deepen through the new technologies that is probably not taking place in the way that it should. I think that we are probably, I'm exaggerating for effect perhaps, so interested in facilitating protest and challenge to authoritarianism that we're probably not thinking deeply enough about what comes after. And that has to be led by the people of these countries centrally, but we have a role to facilitate. So Jim Glassman, I guess what I'm saying is two cheers for social media and political protest. But if we want to fully realize our aims, we have to get back to the freedom agenda. We have to get back to the idea game. We have to listen to the dissidents who are sacrificing, who are on the front lines. And technology is still servant. It's not master. Content is still king. Thank you all.